Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tobin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. Today, we've invited Las Vegas Sun education reporter Paul Takahashi into the studio for an end of the school year wrap-up. Paul, you recently, most recently wrote about a Stanford University study on charter schools that did take a look at Nevada and a collection of other states. What did they find in Nevada in terms of the performance of charter schools?
Sure. So Nevada's charter schools have the worst performance of any charter school in the country. They surveyed, the Stanford University researchers surveyed about 5,000 charter schools across 25 states and Washington, D.C. and New York. And they were able to determine, come up with student data for charter schools and then find matches with traditional public school students, and were able to sort of compare how charter schools were performing versus traditional public schools. And basically, they found that Nevada charter schools in general, students there lose about 6 to 7 months of learning per year in both reading and math. And so while other states are seeing gains, especially in particularly in reading, Nevada's charter schools are still not performing as well.
So when you say losing 6 or 7 months, is that just a metric for determining in terms of where they are in relation to their peers and their educational process, I guess, or growth?
Yeah, in relation to traditional public school students. So, okay. You know, kids who go to regular schools, you know, how they're doing. So basically, charter school students are falling behind their traditional counterparts. Mm-hmm. And so by about 6 to 7 months.
Do we have any indication of why the charter schools here in Nevada aren't necessarily performing as well as the public schools?
Sure. So researchers didn't really go into the explanations. They basically analyzed the data, presented it as is. They didn't really make any policy recommendations or anything like that per se. They did hint at the fact that a lot of states are now beefing up their charter school laws to make charter schools be held more accountable to its students and to taxpayers who are ultimately, you know, putting in taxpayer, you know, per pupil funding into these schools. Now, in terms of how charter schools are how they're faring in Nevada, it's hard to tell because the data that they used is about, you know, 2 or 3 years old. You know, they used, you know, 2010, 2011 data. And so it's difficult to say how charter schools are currently, but at least 2 or 3 years ago, they're performing much lower than their traditional, you know, counterparts here, which is disturbing because charter schools and traditional public schools here aren't performing well anyway across the country. And so, you know, the fact that charter schools are performing worse than even Clark County School District schools, that's really a cause for alarm.
Right. Nevada public schools aren't exactly setting a high bar for comparison. And then the big news towards the end of the school year was the departure of Dwight Jones, right? The superintendent for Clark County School District. Was it the fifth largest school district
That's
in the
right.
country? So it's a big deal to end. He sort of, it was an abrupt departure. Is that right?
It was. He left in March. He said that he had to go take care of some personal issues. He had a mother who was ill in Texas, and so he said that he'll be leaving the district. And so the school board said, well, we need to find a new superintendent. And so there was this long-winded debate over whether or not they should conduct a national search or not. And ultimately, they decided to hire locally. Mm-hmm. And they picked Pat Skorkowski, a 25-year veteran, who started as a first-grade teacher in the school district and sort of rose through the ranks to become superintendent.
And some people weren't exactly happy with the way the board decided, you know, went about the process of appointing him, right?
Right. So there were a smaller contingent, I would say. I think the majority of the public who showed up at community meetings and school board meetings, they were in favor of having, a local candidate, saving the cost for a national search and just putting it towards other classroom uses. There was, a smaller contingent, though, who believe that a national search would yield a wider range of candidates from which the school board could choose and would probably yield the best candidate. And so they wanted to make sure that Skorkowski was the best candidate across the nation, make sure he was properly vetted. And so there were a number of folks who filed complaints against the school district saying that, well, you know, you should have done a national search. There wasn't a job description, issue. There weren't resumes collected or distributed until later in the process. The process in which they chose the superintendent was fairly quick. And, you know, just at a regular school board meeting, they decided, well, they weren't going to do a national search. So they went ahead and picked Skorkowski. And so a lot of folks were sort of miffed by that as well.
Do you think the board was caught off guard by Jones's departure? I mean, in general, was the education community here surprised?
I think so, yeah, definitely. Jones's departure, and then, of course, a short time later, the Nevada superintendent, Jim Guthrie, leaving the state, really leaving behind a leadership vacuum, if you will, for education in the state.
Mm-hmm. And you've had the chance to interview the new superintendent, Pat Skorkowski. So what are his goals? How does he differ from Jones? Is he going to follow with the same plan? What does he say he wants to accomplish?
I think his charge from the school board and the community is to continue a lot of the reforms that were started under Jones. So he hasn't really proposed any new reform ideas of his own. He is adopting a lot of the things that were passed by the legislature, such as the Zoom schools that are putting more resources for English language learner students. He's continuing a lot of the reform efforts under Jones, such as making sure that minority students aren't disproportionately represented in expulsions and disciplinary action in schools. So he's just started, I think. And so, for the first year or so, I think we'll see a lot of the same reforms, being continued, which I think a lot of teachers and a lot of educators are really quite happy about, because, after 2 years of really intense reforms, to have somebody else come in to try to put a stamp on Clark County, I think that would have been a lot more upheaval in the school district.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned ELL. Correct me if I'm wrong, but for the first time ever, we're going to have state funding for ELL students.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah, Nevada was one of about three to, handful of states that didn't have any state funding for ELL students. In the past, they've used federal funding to go towards coordinators and things like that for ELL students. But this is the first time they're investing about $50 million to ELL students. And the majority of those funds are going to go towards 12, about a dozen to 15 schools, mainly in Clark County, that are going to be called Zoom schools. And they're going to have a lot more intensive research resources and then supports for English language learners.
Do you know how many ELL students we have in the county or the state?
I think statewide it's about 53,000 to 55,000 students, and right. So it's one of the larger ELL student populations as a percentage of the total.
Right, and now we, as is sort of typically the case with Nevada schools, we have a laundry list of reports that came out placing us near the bottom.
Right.
So there was the case of Nevada's high school graduation rate is still low. I think it most recently ranked third lowest in the country.
That's
that
correct.
Right. And so what is being done? What has been the approach in terms of trying to get those numbers up?
Sure. So Education Week comes out annually with its diploma counts study, and Nevada still is among the lowest graduation rate in the country. And so it's hard to tell because, again, the data is lagging by 1 year, 1 to 2 years. So it's tough to tell whether the reforms that were placed recently are actually working or not. It's going to take some time for those results to actually show. But the school district is continuing with its Reclaim Your Future initiative next year, where they're going door to door knocking, trying to bring dropouts back to school. They're putting in additional supports for students, such as mentoring. They have individualized sort of learning plans for students who are sort of on the edge. Proficiency boot camps, summer schools, Saturday boot camps to make sure that these kids are passing the proficiency exams. So a lot of those efforts are going to continue under Skorkowski. It's hard to tell if those are really going to make a dent in sort of the graduation rate figures, because all the states are really improving in terms of their graduation rates. We've hit a 40-year high in terms of graduation rates across the country. And so even as Nevada is improving, as did the majority of states, it's not improving at such a fast rate that it's going to automatically become, you know, the middle of the pack or even the top of the pack.
Right. And speaking of proficiency exams, that's been a major issue here, right, in terms of kids getting through their senior year, maybe completing their coursework, but then not able to receive a diploma because they can't pass the state proficiency exams. And so there is a plan in place now to phase those out, right?
Right. So the legislature decided this past session to basically nix the high school proficiency exam, which many critics have contended that it was too difficult. And they sort of looked nationally at graduation rates and all the tests and all the requirements. And a lot of folks here in Nevada believe that Nevada's graduation requirements are too stringent, and especially that proficiency exam is quite stringent compared to other states. I grew up in New Jersey where, you know, at the time, a few years ago, basically they didn't require us to have a science proficiency exam. You know, we did take it, but it didn't count. Nevada students have to pass all four sections, English, math, science, and writing. And so a lot of folks in education believed that it was too difficult, and there was a bit of a time lag between when students took some of these courses and then when they were expected to pass. And so basically they went to these end of course exams. So after they take Algebra 1 or after they take a major course in English, they're going to have to take a end of course exam similar to New York's Regents exams. Mm-hmm. And so immediately after the course ends, when material is fresh in their minds, they're going to take the exam. If they pass, they sort of move on. And they have to pass four of these, two in math and two in reading, in order to receive their diplomas. In addition, the state is now implementing a college readiness exam for students. And so they haven't quite decided which exam they're going to use, but it could be the SAT, the ACT, one of those exams to make sure that students are, it's not going to count towards graduation, but to see if students are college ready. Mm-hmm. If they're ready for college in senior year, they're going to take a lot more intensive courses, AP courses. If they need remediation, they don't want to have them do remedial courses in college. And so they're going to, that senior year, they're going to use that scores from the ACT to say, hey, you know, take a remedial English class to make sure you're prepared for college.
Right. And then other reports, there's the Kids Count Report, which I think is a Maryland-based company, right, that comes out with an annual report on education. And right. So for the second year in a row, Nevada ranked last in the nation, according to that report. And what are they looking at?
So they look at 16 indicators for child well-being. So it's not just education, but education, of course, one of the main factors that, you know, we look at. They look at education, they look at family, community sort of indicators, such as the teen birth rate. They look at economic indicators, such as the number of students in poverty. They look at sort of other sort of social issues as well, health issues relating to kids, such as, number of kids who are insured or not insured. And so Nevada ranked 48th in the country overall and then last in the nation for education. And so Nevada has been improving in a lot of these indicators, I think 11 out of 16, but still, all the states are improving slightly, and Nevada is just not improving quite fast enough.
Mm-hmm. And now there was a star system for our schools here, and that was, is it a new system that was implemented on top of that star system, or I understand there was a sort of a refiguring of the actual school rankings?
Sure. So Clark County had come up with a star ranking, 1 to 5 stars for rating the schools, 1 star being the lowest, 5 stars being the best. And basically the state came up with its own star system, and Clark County is now sort of phasing its star system out and adopting the Nevada. They call it the school performance framework. And basically it's mandated under the waiver that the state received from the federal government to No Child Left Behind, which had a more stringent and very controversial accountability system for schools. And so this system, it takes into account how schools are improving each year, but also proficiency scores as well. So there's a sense of, are we improving? And then also, are we actually meeting the performance targets that we want for our kids? Are they passing those tests and graduating.
And several, was it like 20 five-star schools were actually downgraded to like more of an average 3 stars, right?
Right. So yeah, so Clark County had put a lot more weight in its scales and in its formula on how much schools were improving each year instead of just passing and sort of proficiency rates. And so the state's plan, you know, the state's rating system is a little bit more stringent. And so you're seeing a lot of these five-star schools under Clark County, their SPF sort of falling basically under the states. And so it's a little bit of an adjustment, I think, for these principals who thought they were sort of five-star schools. But again, because they're five-star schools, they're all improving at a better rate than just the regular schools. And so at some point, these schools should be approaching proficiency at some point. And so, you know, they're expected to move from 3-star to 4-star and hopefully eventually 5 stars.
And speaking of evaluations, there's also a new plan in place for evaluating Nevada teachers, right? How's that going to work?
Sure. So in the last in the 2011 legislative session, the state came out with a 4-tiered teacher evaluation system. So before it was just 2-tiered, you know, you were either effective or ineffective. And so the majority of teachers were considered effective. I think it was, you know, more than 98% of maybe even 99% of teachers were considered effective under that plan. And so they wanted to make the rating system for teachers a little bit more nuanced. And so they went to a 4-tier system. This past legislative session, they are looking at ways to make sure that these teachers are sort of being evaluated properly and fairly. And so they are putting in performance evaluations for teachers in the bottom 2 tiers 3 times a year. So they're going to be evaluated by a principal, whereas in the past it was just 2 times a year. And they're going to be looking at a wider range of things for teachers. So instead of just popping into a classroom 2 times a year, seeing how kids were performing, you know, asking parents how the teachers were, they're actually going to be looking at, well, what's the curriculum look like? What are the lesson plans look like? What, you know, what are some of the student reports and some of the student work that, you know, is being done in class? And so they're also asking teachers to put in some more reflective pieces. So, you know, do videos of themselves, you know, in classrooms. So, you know, they see and observe themselves teaching. And so they can say, here's where I need to improve. Here's where, you know, I'm good at. So it's a little bit more nuanced. There's still a question of how the state's going to pay for all this. So there need, you know, principals need to be trained on this new evaluation system, the new rubric for evaluating teachers. They need to be given time to do all these, because, you know, just popping 2 times a year, it's a lot easier than actually reviewing, you know, documents and portfolios for teachers. And so it's gonna be a lot more expensive, and their costs between $10 to $20 million maybe over you know, our additional budget. And so it's hard to tell whether or not this is gonna be cost effective in the long run. But again, you know, in order for all of these in order to incentivize teachers to teach better, they're looking at maybe doing performance pay. So there has to be some kind of metric, some kind of yardstick for measuring how teachers are teaching and how, you know, how they're actually you know, performing. And so if Nevada is going to go towards that route, there needs to be a really strong and robust evaluation system.
And how did the, I imagine this took a lot of debate and negotiation. I mean, how did the teachers respond to this plan?
Right. So the teachers union have been sort of going along. You know, they're on this council called the Teachers and Leaders Council. They're working with the state officials to come up with a fair and equitable way to evaluate teachers. Now, teachers, I think, on the whole, are very apprehensive about this system, because in a lot of states, these evaluation systems have sort of failed. They've either been too lax or too stringent, and just the fact that teachers are being evaluated while other, you know, groups aren't evaluated, I think there's another concern there. There's also a concern of, well, there aren't any tests for physical education or for art, you know, teachers. And so how are you supposed to evaluate these teachers who don't necessarily fall under the standardized reading, you know, math tests? And so there's a lot of concern about whether or not, you know, these performance evaluations that are based on both how teachers are teaching and based on test scores are really going to play out.
And now, speaking of the teachers union, the Nevada Policy Research Institute, a sort of definitely a conservative think tank here in the state that weighs in a lot of issues, is encouraging teachers to drop their union. What's that campaign been about exactly?
Sure. So it's a campaign that started last year. Basically, MPRI is looking to inform teachers of their right to drop the union during a two-week period in July. It's going to be starting fairly soon, and I think it's the first 2 weeks in July. But basically, they want union members to know that they're able to drop their membership and stop paying about $700 each year for their membership. And MPRI is an organization that many teachers contend is a anti-union organization. And so there are some, you know, teachers union members who are sort of trying to fight back basically against that. Basically, membership dues are really important to the, you know, union member, you know, to the unions. And so this is really quite an attack at sort of the financial sort of purse strings of the organization.
And how, I mean, is there any indication of if they've gained traction with this campaign, if teachers are sort of fleeing, you know, sort of dropping the union at any kind of significant rate?
Well, I think nationally you're seeing a lot of teachers dropping union dues. I think, you know, the economy plays a role. There's also a lot of different factors. Just the there are some who argue that unions aren't as important as they were in the past. And so it's very difficult to say why there is such a huge decline in membership. Just nationally, there's been a decline in membership. And so I think Clark County is seeing the same sort of trend happening here.
And you've also been covering the ideas and plans for a new stadium at UNLV. They want to desperately get out of the antiquated and far from campus Sam Boyd. Right. But there's been sort of back and forth agreements that have been broken. So where do we stand now?
Sure. So UNLV, of course, a few months ago dropped its private developer partner, Majestic Realty, backed by Ed Roski, who was the developer for the Staples Center in Los Angeles and owns the Silverton Casino. Basically, Majestic has gone out and come up with its sort of alternative plan for a stadium that's off campus. And they're using about a few acres of Clark County property sort of right off the campus, basically just across the street, basically. And so there's a competing stadium proposal. UNLV is still going ahead with its own proposal for UNLV Now, which the legislature sort of said we're going to put together a study committee, give you a council basically to an authority to, you know, talk with all the stakeholders on the strip, all the casino owners, talk with the industry, basically to see, you know, whether there is a need for a UNLV stadium and then what that stadium is going to look like. And so UNLV's stadium plan is going to be a slow moving plan. They need to get a lot of input from a lot of different stakeholders. And then they're going to have to find some way to fund it. Now, Majestic's plan is going to be a lot faster because they're pouring in, they're promising a lot of money. They don't have as many stakeholders. And basically, if everything goes according to plan, they should be, you know, breaking ground in just a couple of years. And so that is going to be a really interesting look at, you know, who is going to break ground first, and who, you know, I think the first person to put the shovel in the ground is really going to win, I think, this fight.
And you also got, I mean, you obtained a lot of email document and other documents sort of going over that relationship between Majestic and UNLV. What led to that departure, you know, to the split between the two partners?
Well, I think there is a concern that UNLV is saying that there's a concern that Majestic was sort of in the way between UNLV being able to approach different casino operators for money. And, you know, the fact that this private developer was working so closely with the university made a lot of other casinos properties and hotel properties concerned about what kind of benefits they're going to see from, you know, pitching in to help finance the project. And so I think there was a lot of concern about sort of were they going to be able to fund the project properly with sort of having such a close relationship with one casino property, the Silverton and Majestic. So that was I think the primary reason why it fell. Of course, Silverton and Majestic, you know, they're sort of saying, well, we didn't really know, you know, this was going to happen. They were sort of appalled, I think, a little bit. There was also some indication that Majestic wanted to move the project a lot faster. And UNLV being a public entity, everything had to be transparent. Everything had to be approved by both the board, you know, the legislature. And so it was definitely a very slow process. You know, they were hoping to have some kind of tax increment financing district set up this legislative session. That didn't happen. And so it's going to take at least another 2 years basically to get public financing for the project and then for all the stakeholders to sit, you know, agree on a final design. And so I think there was a lot of concern about sort of the pace at which the project was going. And Majestic was pouring in a lot of upfront costs, research dollars, R&D research. There was a lot of concern about that.
And some of the casinos even publicly stated that they were against the plan.
Right. I think, MGM said that they were going to build their own arena. You know, maybe they weren't going to put in, you know, their share. The resort associations said, well, we've got other pressing plans that we need to renovate the LVCVA. And so there were a lot of concerns about whether or not they were going to be able to get all the funding from all these different entities together.
And now a new change also in the schools here is that they will be allowing students to bring in their iPads, iPhones, laptops, and use them at school and access school Wi-Fi, that type of thing. But how's the plan exactly work? Are kids going to be using these things in class? I mean, what about the kids that don't have these devices? How does it work in the school setting?
Sure. So that's really still to be determined, and it's going to be school by school basis. So principals are going to either approve or deny. Sort of, they're given the power basically to allow students to bring them to school. So for years, there was this district policy that banned sort of beepers and pagers and cell phones and other electronic devices unless they were district owned. And so basically, the school district has been experimenting with iPad initiatives. You know, they passed out 7,000 iPads to students at 5 middle schools last year. They're looking to sort of expand all those programs. There is this big push in education to incorporate technology into education. And so sort of following along with that trend, they're trying to give away these technology devices, which are quite costly to the school district. And you can't necessarily, you know, the nation's fifth largest school district with, you know, 311,000 students can't necessarily give each student an iPad or a computer or a laptop like that. So basically, this is a way to save costs for the school district. So by allowing students who have these devices to bring them to school, they're able to use them in class. So, you know, they're able to download an app on their iPhones or their Android devices to, you know, work with in class. They're able to bring tablets to school to help them note-take. And so a lot of these devices are going to be helpful for students, but at no cost to the school district. And it's a policy, it's called the Bring Your Own Technology Policy or Bring Your Own Device, BYOD. And a lot of school districts are sort of looking at that policy and saying this is a cost-effective way to incorporate technology in classrooms.
What about the kids that don't have to, I mean, are they worried about, say, lengthening the gap between like socioeconomically disadvantaged children versus the ones that can't afford to bring their own.
Right. So critics are definitely concerned about that. Are students who don't have the economic resources to buy iPads, are they going to be left behind if the classroom, entire classrooms using iPads and the teachers teaching using an iPad, are kids who don't have their own going to be affected? And I think that's going to be a major concern for a school district like Clark County, where you're seeing, you know, 60% of students who are on the free and reduced lunch program. So I think you're going to see a little bit more of these iPad programs for low-income students continue in the school district to supplement what, you know, kids at some of the more affluent schools are able to bring in on their own. And so, you know, whereas, you know, Summerlin schools or maybe some Green Valley schools may not have their own, you know, they are able to bring their own iPads to school, you know, some of the more urban kind of inner city schools are going to maybe be supplemented by district resources.
All right. Well, a lot happened in the last school year. You've been a busy man, Paul.
Definitely.
Well, thanks for joining. That was Paul Takahashi, the Las Vegas Sun education reporter. Thanks for being with us. And you've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. Our producer is Steven Zeller. See you next week.